Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Susan Shand, and Phil Dierking. But first, here is the Higher Education Report. Almost all job searches require applicants to meet with the people offering the job to answer questions about themselves. Banks often require people asking for a loan to do the same. And even meeting your romantic partner's parents for the first time can feel like an examination of your best and worst qualities. Higher education has similar ways of evaluating applicants, David Coble explains. He works in international student services at the University of Tulsa, a private research university in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Coble says colleges and universities want to know as much as they can about students who want to join their academic programs. Schools get a lot of information about an applicant from their application materials. But there are some things that academic performance records and letters of support from former teachers do not demonstrate.
Many students can look similar on paper, Coble says. So interviews are another method some schools use to learn more about an applicant. Coble notes that interviewing with a college or university admissions official is different from other interviews in several ways. First, Coble says there are two kinds of interviews that a college or university applicant might face. One is called an informational interview. Most colleges and universities in the United States do not require undergraduate applicants to complete an interview. But some offer applicants the choice of asking for such an interview. The result of this interview is not a major part of the selection process, Coble says. But an interview does give an applicant and their school of choice the chance to build a relationship. Admissions officials might ask some general questions, but they also expect students to ask questions as well. Coble suggests that by asking questions of their own, a student shows their interest in attending that school. The more interest a student shows and the stronger a relationship they try to build with the school, the better. But Coble adds that the kinds of questions a student asks are important.
You wouldn't want to ask, "How many international students do you have here at the university?" he told VOA. That's a question you could go find on the website. You would want to ask something more like, "What do you feel that international students contribute to your community?" That shows them that you're really thinking, you're really wanting to know, "What would you value in me as a student?" Coble adds that asking questions that are deeper and less general demonstrates greater interest. They also show that an applicant has researched the school. Undergraduate students should try to make sure they are studying in a program that is the right fit for them. Gathering information about a certain program is the main goal of an informative interview. Doing your research and knowing about a school are also important for the second kind of interview college applicants may face, Coble says. This is called an evaluative interview. Coble notes that, although undergraduate programs may not require an interview, graduate study programs in the United States often do. Evaluative interviews are a chance for admissions officials to ask questions that examine an applicant's qualities and decide if they will be a good fit for a given program.
He suggests applicants do research on the school they are applying to. One common and very important question interviewers may ask is, why do you want to study here? Coble says admissions officials want applicants to show they know exactly what a program offers and why that matters to them. The greater detail an applicant can give as to why the program is right for them, the better. Look at the academic program that you want to study, he said. Look at the faculty. Look at the research that they've done and point out how that fits your goals. They don't want to know that you want to go there because it's close to home or because of the prestige. They want to know that there's a general interest in that. Thoughtful answers are important for all interview questions, Coble says. After all, almost every college and university wants to admit as many different kinds of people as they can. Someone who gives general answers to questions about their strengths and weaknesses, for example, does not demonstrate to the officials how different or special the applicant may be. Saying, well, I'm good at English, or I'm good at math, those are too general, said Coble. Try to get into what strengths you have and how have you used those to be academically strong. And then, with your weaknesses, be honest here. They don't want you to say, I don't have any weaknesses. That will come across as arrogant. Come in with an explanation of what you're doing to overcome those weaknesses.
It is also important that international students understand the general rules of interviews in the United States, Coble says. For example, being on time to a meeting is extremely important in the U.S. So applicants should arrive at their interview no less than 10 minutes before the planned start time. Coble adds that smiling, looking the interviewer in the eyes, and shaking their hand firmly when meeting can all be signs of confidence and honesty. Finally, Coble suggests that applicants should try to act natural and remember the interview is not the only thing that decides if they are admitted. Being calm can help ease the discussion and strengthen the connection between the interviewer and interviewee. And doing practice interviews with friends and family is a good way to feel relaxed during the real thing, he adds. It is also a good idea to start the interview by making brief, informal conversation with the interviewer, Coble says. This helps build the relationship between everyone involved. However, avoid discussing topics like politics and religion. Americans usually do not talk about these subjects with people they do not know very well. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And that brings us to the end of another Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. Just kidding. To kid, to tease, to joke and fool around. They all mean about the same thing. If you kid, you make fun in a playful way. Teasing can be playful or mean-spirited. It depends. To joke around is to have fun with someone. To fool someone is to try to make them believe something that is not true. And that is the purpose of April Fool's Day. April 1st is known as the day to fool people with practical jokes, pranks, or harmless tricks. But how did this tradition begin? Some say April Fool's Day began as one big mistake. Many centuries ago, people in the Western world used the Julian calendar. They celebrated the new year on April 1st. However, when people began using the Gregorian calendar, the new year was moved to January 1st. Those who forgot the change and tried to celebrate New Year's Day on the wrong date were teased and called April Fools. This is just one of the many theories behind the origin of April Fool's Day, but the tradition remains the same, trying to fool someone. The fool is a common character in art, music, and literature. William Shakespeare is famous for his fools, and fools make for great pop songs. Fools are found in many words, expressions, and proverbs. To be foolhardy means to do something that is too dangerous or risky. For example, it is foolhardy to hike up a mountain during a heavy snowstorm. If something is foolproof, it is planned or made so well that nothing could go wrong. Not even a fool could mess it up.
Look, I don't want to get into trouble. This plan of yours sounds risky.
My plan is foolproof. Nothing will go wrong as long as you do exactly as I say.
There are many expressions using the word fool. If you are on a fool's errand, you are doing something that is pointless. For example, asking a friend who has no money for a loan is a fool's errand. Fool's gold is iron pyrite. Iron pyrite is a brassy yellow mineral that is often mistaken for gold. Miners who did not know much about the properties of gold would often mistake iron pyrite for the real stuff. A fool's paradise is not a vacation spot for fools. It is a state of being happy for foolish or unfounded reasons. Here is an example.
Monica is so happy these days. She thinks she is getting a raise at work.
But she is always late. She misses her deadlines. And her boss doesn't really like her.
I know. She is living in a fool's paradise.
Even a smart and reasonable person can be a fool at times. You can be a fool for love, a fool for money, or a fool for success. Basically, you can be a fool for anything that causes you to lose control or lose touch with reality. In this song, Connie Francis sings that everybody is somebody's fool. Fools also find themselves in many common proverbs. For example, a fool and his money are soon parted. This means that if you are not careful with your money, you will soon not have any. Another proverb is, there is no fool like an old fool. This means if an older person behaves foolishly, it seems worse than when a younger person does the same. An older person should know better. Then there is the proverb, "Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me." This means that if you are tricked once by someone, they are to blame for fooling you. But if you let the same person fool you again, the blame is all your own. When George W. Bush was president, he infamously messed up this proverb in a speech. We end this show with yet another foolish proverb. Fools rush in where angels fear to tread. English poet Alexander Pope wrote this line in his 1709 poem, An Essay on Criticism. Songwriter Johnny Mercer turned it into a classic song.
Fools rush in where angels fear to tread.
Share a foolish expression from your language, or practice using one of these expressions. I'm Anna Mateo.
So open up your heart and let this fool rush in.
Being black and working in the technology industry can be a lonely experience. The New York-based not-for-profit group Ascend Leadership examined the employment information of hundreds of San Francisco tech companies in 2007 and in 2015. Ascend used information from the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Ascend found that black tech professional employment decreased from 2.5% in 2007 to 1.9% in 2015. It also found that, although there was a 43% growth in the number of black executives from 2007, blacks still made up just 1.1% of tech executives in 2015. Ari Melenciano is a student in the Interactive Telecommunications Program at New York University. She is African American. "You're in a sea full of people that just don't look like you," Melenciano said of being black in the tech world. So, Melenciano decided to do something about it. She started Afrotechtopia, an event that brings together and celebrates black technologists, artists, designers, and activists. The first ever Afrotechtopia took place at New York University. Attendees discussed their work, as well as the difficulties of working in the mostly white world of tech and new media. "It's really important for us to be able to see ourselves and build this community of people that actually look like us and do amazing things," Melenciano said. Glenn Kontav is founder and chief of the Performance Art Coalition Movers and Shakers NYC. He attended Afrotechtopia. He demonstrated his group's use of augmented reality and virtual reality with apps that help people deal with racism and discrimination. Kontav said, "My parents told me from a very young age that you will not be treated like your white friends." Kontav and his team are working on an augmented reality book for children called White Supremacy 101, Columbus the Hero. The book will include pictures that become animated when viewed with an augmented reality app. The book also will have history lessons told from different perspectives. The lessons avoid the traditional white American perspective. Idris Brewster created the app for the book. He is also Chief Technology Officer of Movers and Shakers NYC. He said technology, such as augmented reality and virtual reality, really provides us with a way to tell a story in a very different way. Brewster also works as a computer science teacher at Google. 2 years ago, only 1% of Google's tech workers were Black. Brewster says he hopes more and more African Americans become creators of technology and algorithms, processes that a computer follows. There's algorithms being created in our world right now that are detrimental to people of color because they're not made for people of color, Brewster said. We need to start being able to figure out how we can get our minds and our perspectives in those conversations, creating those algorithms. Jazzy Harvey is a virtual reality filmmaker. She also attended Afrotechtopia. She came to present her production, Built, Not Bought. The virtual reality film looks at car collectors living in South Central Los Angeles. Harvey says she feels greater creative freedom when working with virtual reality. There's no rules, and that fact that I have no rules, I get to choose which story is worth telling. Afrotechtopia attendees discussed many topics, from digital entrepreneurship to education. But the main goal of the event was to have African American technologists come together in one place. Melanciano said, to come into a space where you can just be yourself and talk the way that you actually talk and really have people that can connect with you culturally is so important. I'm Susan Shand.
American Chris Spear has been cooking food for others since he was 16 years old. Spear has worked for a chef at large restaurants and even had almost 100 employees reporting to him. But there came a time when he grew tired of this job and wanted to be more creative. So he stopped working for restaurants and set up his own food catering business. It is called Perfect Little Bites. Spear told VOA that spending many hours preparing food doesn't make him feel tired. But he was concerned that becoming an independent chef and not working in a restaurant would make him feel lonely. That led him to create an online networking group called Chefs Without Restaurants. It is a place for chefs to exchange ideas, advice, and even customer referrals. Spears says that while the service is new, the idea for it is not. I've been thinking about the Chefs Without Restaurants for about 5 years now. Even before I took Perfect Little Bites full-time.
because I kept thinking about, well, when I do this full time, who are going to be my colleagues? Who are going to be the people who I can bounce ideas off? How am I going to be able to do things like cater an event that's maybe outside my range of 30 people? Like, do I have a resource where I can pull in one or two other people? Spears said he didn't feel like having full-time employees for his catering business, but he did want a way to communicate with others in the food preparation business. The online group started last January. Since then, around 100 chefs have joined it. Spears said that independent chefs have many different kinds of businesses, but don't always get recognized. He wanted to use the group to bring attention to chefs who normally would not get it. I wanted to have something that's beneficial, but also didn't cost money. We are a Facebook group where I can just post and say, hey, next Wednesday, a customer wants to do dinner here. And the price range, where they live. If anyone is maybe interested, send me a personal message and I get you their information. Spears thinks this network can help those not working in the food service industry. He and other chefs are building a website that lists the group's members, what their specialties are, which ones are able to cater large parties, and personal chefs for smaller events. Lana and Bobby Browner are a wife and husband team who own their catering business, Bent and Bent Events, in Frederick, Maryland. The Browners specialize in Creole and Caribbean cooking. They also prepare and mix together foods that are available locally in Frederick County, Maryland. When the Browners heard about Chefs Without Restaurants, they decided to become members. The biggest difficulty for many chefs, they said, is that they don't often form partnerships because they are competing for business. But you don't have that in this group, Lana Browner noted. What we experienced so far is a lot of learning about different chefs in the area. It's even been interesting to get comments from chefs that work outside Frederick, she added. Chefs Without Restaurants is also bringing more businesses to local eateries. One example is Maryland Bakes, a place where members often meet and prepare food in a common area. Terry Rowe, owner of Maryland Bakes, says the group brings more energy to local small food businesses. They bring connections, she said. They bring creative ideas and just the whole network of independent people joining together. The group is popular with the local food community. Olive Oil and Vinegar is one of the local stores Spear likes to visit. It often holds events to present cooking ideas and let chefs meet their customers. Store owner Sharon Streb says small businesses should help one another succeed. I think by sharing that and having them come to the store, Streb explains, they get in front of our customers and hopefully we get in front of their customers. That's a win-win for both of us. She adds that it's difficult for small businesses, and many don't succeed. So it's important they work together. I'm Phil Deerking.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.